In Baghdad, Hussein's his middle name.
It is time for us to transition to the Iraqis. They need to take responsibility for their country and for their sovereignty. And in order for them to do that, they've got to make political accommodations.
Hey, does no mean yes in Baghdad? Well, for the boots on the ground in Iraq, what sounds to some civilians like a no for the military actually means an enthusiastic yes. Obama faces the troops, gauging style and substance on the Obama World Tour. Commander-in-Chief performance on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, April 8th. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi Okeh, sitting
in.
Good morning. Well, she's Adora Udoji is away. I'm sitting in for her. She's out with baby Siobhan. So coming up this hour, the SEC tackles short selling on Wall Street. And the NCAA says it puts academics first, but 42% of black men who play Division I basketball don't graduate. Are they going pro or going nowhere? And the tables have turned in the case of former Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens.
Oh, yeah.
From the hunter to the hunted, we'll talk about what's in store for the prosecutors. But first, headlines.
Somali pirates hijacked a cargo ship flying a U.S. flag off the coast of Somalia early this morning. 20 of the crew members are American, according to reports from a Kenyan diplomat and U.S. Navy officials. All of the crew members are believed to be safe. The vessel is the sixth to be hijacked since Saturday. Officials had thought that Somali pirates were backing down as a massive international naval fleet moved in to protect cargo ships in the region. Vermont is now the fourth state where same-sex marriage is legal in the U.S. Beth Robinson is chairwoman of Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force. She says there are differences between same-sex marriage and civil union.
There's a host of sort of what you might call tangible stuff, but I actually think the inclusion it represents and the opportunity to participate in the same legal and social institutions that our neighbors do is very much at the core of this.
What changed? The Vermont State Legislature took one day to overturn Governor Jim Douglas's veto of a bill legalizing gay marriages. Femi, what else we got?
Illinois has a new congressman. A Chicago Democrat, Mike Quigley, has won the Illinois seat left vacant by President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. Quigley won with 70% of the vote, and he's known as a reformist in the Illinois Democrat Party. And the Yukon Huskies are now the women's NCAA basketball champs. The team beat the Louisville Cardinals 76-54.
Stomp.
Yeah, the game was tied midway through the first half, but then Yukon took the lead and never looked back. Yukon center Tina Charles.
We snap back to reality and realize if we don't play well, we could lose the game. This is a good team that we were playing against in Louisville, and I'm just excited.
Oh, yes. This is UConn's sixth national title, John.
And Tina was in double figures in both points and rebounds. The Dow and the S&P begin trading today at 77.90 and 8.16, respectively. How much parents should tell their children about their lives in the Internet age? That's the question for all of you this morning at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Now, where do you draw the line? And kids, what has a parent told you you wish they hadn't? In the age of full disclosure on the Internet, how do you control personal information when you're a parent? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
You can't handle the truth!
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, markets fell yesterday. A little blippy volatility in advance of corporate earnings, which are expected not to be terribly good. But what do you make of that? You know, if you're the kind of person who thinks the market will never go up again, we would call you, Femi, a pessimist, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, if you're going to say, you know, the market's going to go down for a while, we would probably call you a realist, right?
Yeah, pragmatic.
But if you make millions and millions of dollars betting that the stock market would go down, we have a very special name for you. You're a short seller, and the Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't like them so much. The SEC meets today to unveil several proposals aimed at restricting short selling. It, as we just referred, is a technique used by investors to profit from falling stock prices, and it has the tendency to make them fall even further, maybe if it's not warranted. Joining us now is John Coffey, professor at Columbia Law School. He's director of the Law School's Center on Corporate Governance. He joins us from his home. Professor Coffey, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Help us to understand how you can make lots of money betting that stocks go down without getting into puts and calls too arcane a way.
Basically, you make money by buying low and selling high, and you can do that in either direction. You can sell first and buy later at a lower price to cover that sale. That's short selling. And if the price is going to go down, then the way to make money is to sell first and buy later.
Now, the pressure that this puts on, particularly bank stocks, has caused the Securities and Exchange Commission to worry. What is, first of all, the rule that's in place to restrict short sellers, and how is the SEC going to take another look at this today?
Well, the SEC last year, briefly for a 30-day period, did bar all short selling in financial stocks. That was a short-term rule. They've also barred something called naked short selling, which is a more abusive practice. But the SEC liberalized short selling 2 years ago, back in 2006, actually, when they said that they would abolish their traditional uptick rule. That rule had been there for 50 years, and it essentially said you can only sell short if the market is rising or level. As soon as the market heads down, short selling is barred till the next uptick in the opposite direction. That restrained short selling. The SEC abolished that in the belief that an efficient market should have both optimists and pessimists equally unfettered to trade as they saw fit.
And is that what's happening now in the market?
Well, the view of the business community, which is pushing very hard for further restrictions on short selling, is that in periods of market stress, short sellers can create a self-fulfilling prophecy by putting the market under pressure and causing other shareholders to fear further price declines. The SEC is a little divided on what it wants to do here, and I think their basic impulse is to try to make short selling more of a counter-cyclical policy by restricting it during periods of market stress.
All right, well, there are two things to ask really here. On the one hand, does the SEC have the ability to, it seems in some sense, regulate the psychology of the market, say, you know, regulate to the extent of forcing everyone to take antidepressants to keep the market from falling lower? It seems that's what this is kind of like.
Well, the SEC can't do that. Obviously, such efforts could well prove counterproductive. I think the SEC could try to restrict short selling to periods of market enthusiasm. That is, if you were to adopt what I'll call a circuit breaker rule that says if the market in a particular stock falls 15%, then there can be no more short selling that day. I think you give investors some insurance that there won't be an artificial pressure caused by those who want to panic the market.
Well, ultimately, though, it seems that the SEC is being very reactive here, and that what is possibly required is for Congress to take a much broader look, as Secretary Geithner has suggested on a couple of occasions, at retooling the entire regulatory scheme of the Securities and Exchange Commission. First of all, do you think that's a good idea, likely to happen, and how would it happen?
I think that's a very necessary idea. Let's give some focus to it, though.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think Secretary Geithner and the Treasury Department and the prior administration and much of the world right now, looking at the G20 group, believes is that we need a systemic risk regulator. We have to move beyond simply worrying about disclosure and transparency, important as those topics are, and have one agency or a collection of agencies authorized to regulate the capital structure, leverage, debt-to-equity ratio, and safety and soundness of all financial institutions.
Okay, Professor, just hold on 1 second. I'm one of your grad students, and I'm a little shaky, all right? Systemic risk regulator. How is that different from some giant, huge sort of rating agencies that evaluates everything from mortgages to stocks?
Well, no, the systemic risk regulator is really something like the Federal Reserve writ large. The Federal Reserve has authority over banks and bank holding companies. But with the convergence of financial institutions, there are now a lot of quasi-banks, hedge funds, insurance companies like AIG, investment banks, and new entities we haven't even seen yet, all of which do the same thing as banks. And the real meaning to systemic risk is that there's a possibility of these interlinked institutions experiencing a kind of cascade of falling dominoes under which the failure of one pulls down all the other dominoes that are entangled with it. That's the role of a systemic risk regulator, to try to ensure a kind of financial adult supervision over these institutions that are too big to fail.
But, Professor Coffey, weren't hedge funds created to get out from under existing regulations, and won't bankers and financiers find some way to get out from under even a new umbrella, as broad as it might be?
Well, I think that depends on what authority you give the systemic risk regulator. If it is told that it can decide that any institution is systemically significant and therefore falls within its ability to have oversight over their capital adequacy and their safety and soundness, that's a kind of prudential financial regulation, very different from what the SEC does, which is fundamentally a disclosure and enforcement agency. And I think that's something that's coming around the world today, as we're recognizing that the costs of a financial institution failing are just too great. If you're too big to fail, then you've got to be regulated so that you don't fail.
Now, a lot of people who look at the SEC say, in fact, all I really want the SEC to do is prevent another Bernard Madoff. Why should regulation be beyond simply, backstopping corruption and the kinds of Ponzi schemes that the Madoff scandal is all about?
Well, I think that's what the SEC is best at. Every institution has its own special competence. I think the SEC, when it works well, is a good enforcement agency, a good disclosure agency. I don't think it's capable of what I'll call financial oversight of the safety and soundness of financial institutions. That's more the role of the classic banking regulator, such as the Federal Reserve. And we're going to have a world in which we'd likely to have these two agencies coming into possibly conflict or possibly interaction, but they're both going to have a role with respect to those financial institutions that could destabilize our entire economy by their failure.
Professor Coffey, I don't mean to be annoying here, but you did just say that the thing that the SEC does best is prevent Madoffs. That's a sad commentary.
That's traditionally what they're best at.
Ouch.
They really are a disclosure agency. They're not an agency that tells financial institutions that they need more capital or their debt-to-equity ratio is too high.
Well, finally, looking at this bank stimulus package and bank rescue plan that has come out of Treasury and all of the headlines that we've had over the last 6 months, it seems as though Treasury is much more comfortable keeping Congress out of this, attempting to use the Fed's balance sheet to regulate the banks and to help the banks without congressional oversight. What makes you think they're going to invite Congress in and do something that would really rewrite regulations from top to bottom?
Well, what they did propose last week was this resolution authority so that they could use a quick form of bankruptcy reorganization without going through the long bankruptcy process. And what they proposed was that all systemically significant financial institutions be subject to a very quick financial reorganization if they become insolvent. This is all a response to the Lehman failure, which has convinced much of the world that we can't go through a 10-year process of reorganizing a very large financial institution, but have to do it much quicker. And so they were seeking legislation there. But I think you're right. They probably are trying to avoid Congress to a degree. I think the public-private partnership proposal is essentially a way to avoid having to go back to Congress and seek greater funding authority.
All right, Professor, before we go, I hate to get into the predictions game, but I can't resist asking you, what do you think the SEC is going to do today?
I suspect they're going to take an intermediate position. They may put out several proposals, but I think rather than simply reinstating the uptick rule, they would prefer to try to put in a circuit breaker system under which we would have an uptick rule kick in only when a particular stock has fallen some percentage level. That is what I'll call a counter-cyclical policy, which would restrict short selling during periods of market stress. And I think that's probably the safer compromise.
Well, and the futures trading on Wall Street suggests that there's a cautious look ahead at what the SEC is going to do. Thanks for helping me through all that, Professor.
My pleasure.
Would you say I pass?
You get an excellent grade.
All right, John Coffey, professor at Columbia Law School. He's the director of the Law School's Center on Corporate Governance. Thinking about what the Securities and Exchange Commission is going to do today when they relook at the uptick rule and other consequences of short selling on Wall Street and world markets.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So if you can go into the library, turn on a computer and Google your mom and find out she worked in a strip joint back in her 20s, is it even possible to keep personal information about parents from children? How much do they know? Where do you draw the line? What's your strategy? We want to mobilize you this morning. You're all out there Twittering and Googling and everything. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. What is something your parent told you in their personal life that you wish they hadn't? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
So President Obama squeezed quite a bit into his overseas trip that ended this week. 8 days in Europe, plus a surprise visit to Iraq. David Sanger is the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, and he's been covering the trip. We've been checking in with him pretty regularly. He joins us now from Washington this morning. David, to reflect on this trip, would you say that the president came away with a grand plan of where America is placed in world politics?
You know, I don't think you could call it a grand plan yet. And, you know, I wrote in this morning's paper that if you were looking for a grand strategy out of this trip, the closest thing you got to one was in his description of the future of nuclear weapons in the world. But if you looked at the financial side of the trip, which was how it began, the G20 part, and then when he went to NATO to deal with Afghanistan and Pakistan, there was no grand strategy. There was sort of ad hoc solutions there. And on those in those areas, for all of the incredible response that he and certainly Michelle Obama got from the public, he didn't come away with an extraordinary amount of cooperation or joint action. So this was one of those trips where the tone of it and the theatrics of it, I think, were enormously successful. The substantive reordering of the world part of it was less so.
Well, I guess, you know, how do you interpret that? You wrote this book called The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. And that sounded, you know, when I first heard the title, like something, you know, sort of depressing for Barack Obama to confront. But it seems like the best thing, going for Barack Obama is the fact that he's not Bush. He shows up and is not Bush, and the crowd goes wild.
That's
Inheritance,
right.
Forget it. It's like a, you know, it's like a trust fund.
Yeah, it's... Remember, this was the first trip, John. So, you know, there was the novelty element there. I mean, you went through the London papers every day, and you found about four pages of coverage of either their visits to Buckingham Palace or Michelle Obama wowing everybody at the schools or whatever. There was a little bit of Jack Kennedy and Jacqueline showing up in Europe, you know, going on here. So you had to get past a little bit of the buzz in order to get to this next point. But you're right. This was the anti-Bush doctrine trip. If there wasn't a grand strategy around what Obama was saying, I think, John, that's because that was the point, that he was saying there is not going to be American doctrine that then leads to American dictates.
David, you talk about the spectacle of the trip, but let's break it down a little bit and see where the president actually scored points or maybe lost points. Looking at the global financial system and what America got out of that and G20, what's the takeaway there?
You know, in that area, he had come in hoping that there would be some kind of coordinated stimulus package so that every country would be sort of firing at the same time, kind of like having all six cylinders in your engine burning gas at the same moment to get to a critical mass, or if it's my old car, three cylinders. But what happened instead was that there was an announcement of $1.1 trillion of additional stimulus that when you picked it apart, you discovered was largely either old commitments or not real money, except for a few hundred billion of it. So in that area, I don't think he got very much. just before he left, he announced that we were sending an additional 21,000 troops to Afghanistan. What he got from all of the rest of NATO was an additional 5,000, most of whom are just there temporarily for the election. So I found those areas less than impressive.
What about the president's relationship and America's relationship with the Muslim world? I know the president was talking about that specifically when he was in Turkey. Does that get him any plus points?
I think that did. You know, he went in there and he was introduced as Barack Hussein Obama. When that happens here in the United States, it's usually a conservative group emphasizing the word Hussein to suggest in some way, you know, that he is a practicing Muslim, which, as we know, he's not. But what did he do? He stood up and he said, you know, America's made up of many parts, and there are a lot of people who are either Muslims practicing in the country or who have family who are Muslims. And he said, I know because I'm one of them. And I think that took him an enormously long way. It particularly took him a long way when he began to discuss the basketball skills of two Turkish NBA players. For sort of a feel-good of we're here to understand the issues surrounding the Muslim world, Turkey was the perfect place to start. And he did not lecture to them about the wonders of secular democracy, which Turkey has had. And he did not try to make the argument that the rest of the Muslim world should look just like Turkey, which was essentially the argument you got out of the Bush administration.
And he didn't disclose whether he's, you know, pro zone defense or is more of a 3-point shooter when he was talking to the NBA players.
He didn't, but if you look at the way this administration has been operating in its first 80 days, John, these are zone defense guys.
David Sanger, he checked in with us before the president's visit, during the president's visit, and after the president's visit. He's obviously our friend. And David Sanger is also chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and The Challenges to American Power. And now time for news headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 28 minutes after the hour. Vermont lawmakers narrowly overrode the governor's veto to legalize gay marriage yesterday. It's now the fourth state to make it legal and the first to do so by legislation as opposed to a court ruling. Opponents and supporters alike say the vote will motivate activists in other states to take actions on both sides. Several other states have bills in the works. Illinois has a new congressman. Chicago Democrat Mike Quigley has won the Illinois seat left vacant by President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. Quigley won with 70% of the vote. He's known as a reformer in the Illinois Democratic Party. Quigley will now represent most of the north side of Chicago. Incidentally, it's the same congressional seat once held by impeached Illinois governor, former governor Rod Blagojevich. Quigley will serve the remainder of the 2-year term Emanuel won back in November.
They're cheering for Quigley.
That's the sound of mass protests in Thailand, actually. I don't have a translation, but they're angry. Essentially, they want the current prime minister to step aside. They accuse a royal advisor of organizing the 2006 ouster of former prime minister Thaksin Shinawat. John and Femi.
Thank you, Mark.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, I'm Femi Okay, sitting in for Adora Udoji, who's spending time with her brand new baby. Now, this isn't an issue that Adora is going to have to face anytime soon, but when your entire life is on Facebook and the internet, how much should you tell your children about your life? Where do you draw the line? And kids, What has a parent told you that you wish they hadn't? Call 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. John.
All right, so March Madness, it's over. It's April now. The NCAA finals for the men and women are finished. But every March, the question is posed, what are we doing here in the NCAA? Are we playing games, or are we getting an education?
There are 380,000 NCAA student-athletes. And most of us will go pro.
Most of us will go pro in something other than sports.
In something other than sports.
The NCAA calls them student-athletes, but every year around this time, some people might want to turn that around and call them athlete-students. What is the priority in NCAA schools? Almost half of all African-American men from NCAA Division I basketball teams are not likely to go pro in any sport because they don't graduate. And that's according to a recent study out by the University of Florida's Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports. Michigan State lost in the final game, but this probably has even more sting. Michigan State has the greatest disparity in graduation rates among Sweet 16 teams. All of its white players graduated. Only 43% of its black players got a diploma. Joining us now is Dr. Boyce Watkins, professor of finance at Syracuse University and founder of YourBlackWorld.com. He joins us from the studios of WRBO in Oswego, New York. Dr. Watkins, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, that Michigan State stat is really disturbing. What's going on here? I mean, there's a recruiting issue, it seems, and then there's also a responsibility issue once these young men get into school. Why the dropout rate so high?
Well, there are a multitude of factors. But one thing we have to understand is that money is a drug, and the NCAA, in my opinion, as a finance professor and as a capitalist, they have all the elements of a professional sports league. I mean, they make more money during March Madness than the NFL makes in its entire postseason, Super Bowl included. They make more than the Major League Baseball. They make more than the NBA does in their postseason. So this is serious money. And so what this drug of money does to many institutions, in my opinion, is that it leads these institutions to sort of deviate from their academic mission, almost like how a drug addicted mother doesn't take good care of her kids. And so as a result of that, you have these students that are brought in as hired guns for the university. You have a lot of athletes that are brought into campuses with strong athletics programs, and no one in their right mind thinks for one second that some of these guys are actually going to stay to graduation, and that's a problem.
Well, what regulations are in place now that attempt to enforce some sort of academic standards in NCAA Division I schools, and what might be added to make this a better situation?
Well, there are certain regulations in place that allegedly limit the number of hours that coaches can force athletes to spend practicing. There are some other regulations on graduation rates and, on GPAs that you have to have in order to play. I think that the challenge, though, is that incentives roll downhill. And you've never seen a coach get rewarded for graduating players if that coach is losing games. At the same time, a coach that's winning games and not graduating anyone is going to get a raise, a promotion, and a $20, $30 million contract. So effectively, the universities are saying out of their mouths, yes, academics matters to us, but when the rubber meets the road, so to speak, and their actions are speaking, they're saying, we want you to win, and that's really all that matters. So what you really need is you need external oversight from individuals like me who don't care if the team wins or not. All I care about is seeing that kid actually gets the education that his or her parents think that they are getting.
But Dr. Watkins, you say you're a capitalist. I'm wondering if there's any way to regulate in a situation where at a lot of NCAA Division I schools, the football coach or the basketball coach makes considerably more than even Nobel Prize winning scientists on campus. In many cases, they're the highest paid employee of the entire university system.
Well, let's be real. You're dealing with a multi-billion dollar industry. And the most beautiful thing in the world for the NCAA is that they've gotten people to take their eye off the ball and to focus on things like graduation rates. Because when we're focusing on graduation rates, we're not looking at how much money these guys are making off of these young kids. People don't understand that there's roughly a $1 to $2 billion wealth extraction from the black community being done here by the NCAA. If you look at the statistics across college sports, you'll find that many of the athletes, the generators of wealth, the generators of this revenue, tend to be African American. But these guys don't get chances to be coaches later. I think 4 out of 120 college football coaches were African American. Most of the commentators who make money from the sport and the athletic directors who make money from the sport are not African American, and the coaches signing these $30, $40 million contracts aren't typically African American. So to some extent, graduation rates is really the first step toward NCAA reform and regulation.
Boyce, this is Femi Okeh here. Are any of the universities actually really making sure that the standard of education for African American players stays high? Are there any universities that you look to and go, they're doing a good job?
Well, I think that our national champion, the University of North Carolina, is doing a better job than most. Their graduation rates are pretty high. Schools like Duke and others, they tend to do a good job. On the other side of the fence, you have schools like Arizona and Texas that have graduation rates that are absolutely horrible. They're below 20%. And I think that schools like that should not be allowed to play in the NCAA tournament.
We've got to go, but I can't resist asking you this last question. Dr. Watkins, does the NBA bear any responsibility here, especially for players who do go pro like LeBron James and, who forego college altogether?
No, I don't think the NBA is the problem here. Remember, you're dealing with sports in which half of the African-American athletes who play Division I college football or college basketball, they come from poverty. So the lure of the NBA is very simple. I can get money and I can take care of my family. You can't blame a young man for wanting to take care of his family. Where the NBA does bear some responsibility is that they want to help implement rules that will force players to stay in college for a year or two before they get a chance to go pro. And they claim that they're doing this to protect the athlete when the reality is that they're helping the NCAA protect their revenue by forcing the next LeBron James to play at the college level.
Well, the story in the headline might be Money Talks Louder Than Good Grades. Dr. Boyce Watkins, finance professor at Syracuse University, founder of YourBlackWorld.com. Thanks so much. Now some headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thanks, John. 20 minutes before the hour, President Obama is now back in the U.S. after making a surprise visit to see troops in Iraq during an 8-day visit abroad. Tomorrow he plans to tackle military health care. Friday the focus is the economy. Several members of Congress had a rare meeting with Fidel Castro in Cuba yesterday. The small group also met with current President Raul Castro. Democratic Congressman Barbara Lee was on the takeaway earlier. She mentioned that he had actually an interest in Martin Luther King. He had a lot of questions about American civil rights and so on like that. You can hear the entire conversation with the congresswoman who met with Fidel Castro and Raul Castro at thetakeaway.org.
Yeah, and it's not her first meeting. She's a bit of an expert, actually.
You bet.
It's interesting to talk to her. Thanks, Mark.
How are you, Fidel?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi Okeh. Ethicist Randy Cohen is bringing his moral take on the news to the New York Times this week in a new project called The Moral of the Story. Moral issue number one this week is Madonna's attempt to adopt a little girl in Malawi. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning, Femi.
What are your new ethical angles on Madonna's adoption saga?
I was impressed that so many people felt, well, why doesn't she just give money to help children if she cares so much about children? And to me, the distinction is it's a lovely thing if she does, but that's not an obligation just of people who want to adopt. Helping suffering children is an obligation of all of us. And I don't think anyone had made that point, at least in the things I'd read.
You raise a ton of questions and give no answers. Why?
No, you take that back. I think that's a pretty clear answer.
Okay. Well, let me take you through the answer.
Well, you really made him mad. And he's the ethicist guy.
He's all right. He's on the phone.
So
you
can
be
in trouble. Okay. My ethical strictures, I can't send you to hell. You're thinking of the priest.
All right. So, Randy, let me give you a few examples. You talk about whether people should adopt locally rather than adopt internationally. Help those at home first.
Yes, yes. I'm quite clear about that. That I say, while it's an admirable thing to adopt locally, the reason many people don't is because they can't. And then I believe if you read the whole piece, you'll find I'm quite clear in saying that while in the 18th century, it was was felt that you had a much greater obligation to help those at home, that a more modern view is that our ethical obligations extend globally. I hope it was clear that I'm endorsing the latter view, since I don't wear a powdered wig and live in the 18th century.
why
well,
people...
right, I wear a powdered wig, but that's between me and my therapist.
Yeah. Nice. See, I find this really interesting because I was fostered by a white family, so I have a lot of dilemmas with this story. And
I'll bet. Yeah,
many of
sure.
them you raised, and many you got many responses. Are you going to have a debate with over 200 people who message you back?
What I liked is it's I do have a chance to respond to the points the readers make, but it's not a debate. I was impressed at how generous spirited the tone of their comments. It's as if this were a problem we're all wrestling with together. We're all trying to sort it out. While we sometimes disagree, it was with such civility, such courtesy, as if we're working together to try to find a good approaches to these kind of problems. Not a debate at all, I think.
Randy, why do people view Madonna as more of a collector than a mom? What is it about her that makes people raise that question?
In my view, jealousy. She makes it easy to make fun of her, since she is an essentially silly person. I think once you've changed your hair color the seventh or eighth time, people are allowed to mock you. But there's also a jealousy element in it, I think, that she's extremely glamorous. She's a self-made success. She's still a pop star at 50. We have to make fun of her. Otherwise, what will we do? Crawl into our, you know, back into our beds and start weeping at the failures we've made of our own lives.
How are you picking your ethical issues to talk about in the news? Are you listening to people? Are you overhearing what they're talking about, Randy?
Well, you make it sound quite sinister. I believe there's some sort of court order they get against that sort of thing. Isn't it illegal if I, like, actually go into their houses?
You want to, though. I can hear that in your voice.
That's why we have those court orders. Sure. The task is always to try to pick a story that the readers will find interesting and that one is aware of what stories are particularly striking in the news and what at least your own friends and the people you know are caught up in.
Randy Cohen, author of the new Moral of the Story blog on the NewYorkTimes.com.
I enjoy talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Femi Okeh, sitting in for Adora Udoji, who's off with her new baby at the moment. So your entire life is out there on Facebook and on the internet. How much of your life should you tell your kids about? And that's a conversation we're having all day online. Where do you draw the line as a parent? And kids, what has a parent told you that they wish, that you wish they hadn't told you? So Katie sent us an email. On my college graduation, my father told me about the affair he had and a little half-sibling I now have somewhere in the city. Happy graduation. Thanks for sharing, Katie. Call us with your story, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Time for some news headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 12 minutes before the hour, and Vermont is now the fourth state where same-sex marriage is legal. The Vermont state legislature quickly overrode Governor Jim Douglas's veto of a bill legalizing gay marriage yesterday. Somali pirates have control of a cargo ship, and the ship's owner says there are 20 Americans on board. The vessel is the sixth to be hijacked in a week. That's a sharp increase from earlier this year. The death toll in Italy's earthquake is now at 260. Rescue workers will continue to search the rubble for survivors for another day. They've been hampered, though, by hundreds of aftershocks since the 6.3 magnitude quake hit central Italy on Monday. John and Femi.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark Garrison. So if Ted Stevens is in the headlines, it's safe to say, based on all the news over the past couple of months, you really don't know what to expect.
Here comes boogity, boogity. There goes boogity, boogity. And he ain't wearing no clothes. Oh, yes, they call him the street.
That's Ray Stevens, actually no relation to Ted Stevens at all, but irresistible. Joining us is Libby Casey, reporter for the Alaska Public Radio Network in Washington. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Alaska Network. Libby, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Stephen Gillers, professor of legal ethics at New York University, joins us by phone. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Man, that was a blockbuster yesterday. All Ted Stevens said was this.
Tell them all I'm going to enjoy this wonderful day, that's all.
A wonderful day, that's right, because the former senator was not only cleared of corruption charges, but the people that went after him were practically hauled off to jail. Libby Casey was in court. What happened, Libby?
Well, Judge Sullivan has had some major blow-ups in the courtroom during the trial when he found out prosecutors hadn't turned over information to the defense. But yesterday, his anger was controlled and simmering, and he virtually spat out his words to the assembled audience. Now the Justice Department lawyers who have been criticized and are being accused of misconduct were not in the courtroom, so he wasn't able to sort of vent his spleen on them. But he had some very strong words and said this case has been shocking and disturbing, and in his nearly 25 years on the bench, he hasn't seen anything approaching the mishandling and misconduct in this case.
Stephen Gillers, let's talk about what the recourse is. The issue was raised in court that maybe there is some sort of punitive action that the judge can take against the prosecutors. Is there any precedent for that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Judges can appoint special prosecutors to recommend, if advised, a prosecution for a criminal contempt or obstruction of justice. And that's what this fellow Schulke is going to do now. He's going to look at all the documents and decide whether or not to recommend a prosecution.
So let's talk about the Justice Department then, to both of you. This was a case that initiated during the George W. Bush era. Eric Holder, the current attorney general, decided to walk away from this case and actually recommended that Ted Stevens be cleared. How much of this is a matter of succession, and how much of this does Eric Holder have to deal with for the next 4 years, Libby Casey?
Well, the judge yesterday really focused his criticism on Attorney General Michael Mukasey, who was appointed under George W. Bush and had nothing but high praise for Holder and everyone. Ted Stevens himself thanked the new Attorney General. So Holder's really trying to turn over a new leaf here, and this was a display by him that nonsense will not be tolerated, misconduct will not be tolerated. You know, though, he sort of had to do this because more evidence was uncovered just 2 weeks ago that wasn't turned over to the defense, and Ted Stevens' lawyers would have had a field day with this.
So, Stephen Gillers, what is the question of succession here? We saw that the U.S. attorney scandal under the Attorney General Gonzalez, where politically motivated firings of U.S. attorneys suggested that the Justice Department was kind of a political arm of the executive branch. Is this another example? Is the Ted Stevens prosecution another example of politics at DOJ? And how much of this is Eric Holder going to have to deal with, of stuff that's under the rocks we might not even know about?
I don't think we can politicize the Stevens prosecution. He was a Republican, after all, and indicted by a Republican administration. So it's not like former Governor Siegelman of Alabama, who was a Democrat, who was indicted by a Republican administration. Holder has changed the tempo, changed the temperature in the room with his remarkable, almost revolutionary decision to drop this case. We may find out that there's more beneath the rock than we know so far. It may be a lot worse than has so far become public to justify that decision.
But we've seen in the past few years the rise of U.S. attorneys as very, very visible public figures. It's almost like the Spitzerization of the U.S. attorney's office, where people make names for themselves in almost autonomous prosecutorial dramas. Is there any way to correct that, and is that a good thing?
There's no way to correct it. You know, there are hundreds of U.S. attorneys. The prominent examples are few in comparison. I mean, the most prominent, I guess, is Rudolph Giuliani when he was U.S. attorney. There's no way to correct it. People do use that position as a stepping stone to politics. That's always been so. It will always be so. What we saw in the Bush administration is almost an unabashed politicization of the Justice Department at every level. And Holder has told us now that's not going to happen anymore, and that's obviously good.
Well, we shall see. So what does Ted Stevens do now, Libby Casey?
That is the million-dollar question. He left yesterday with his family, and this was very emotional. He really treated this like his Rocky moment, like he'd come back from behind and taken victory. His daughters were crying, and all of his supporters and staffers were acting like he'd been exonerated, and that's not necessarily the case. It's not that he has been found not guilty. the Justice Department just really screwed up. As to what he's going to do next, he says one thing he would like to devote some time to after the dust clears is to making sure problems like this don't happen to future defendants. So he may be lobbying and working with his former Senate colleagues to try to change the laws a little bit. He was himself an attorney. He is an attorney, rather. And he has a lot of experience in that. He was worked for the government as a lawyer. We're not sure, though, what he's going to do. He has a home here in Washington. He has a home in Alaska.
He could buy some new furniture. That's a big question. That home in Alaska. He could,
right. Well, we think he'll probably spend a lot of time here, but the question is, what can he do that's valuable with his life? Because he is such an active person. He's 85 years old, but this guy, I mean, he's not ready to retire, that's for sure.
Well, I covered Ted Stevens when I was in Washington years and years and years ago. If I was Sarah Palin, I would be worried about him running for governor. Libby, you want to get into some wild speculation?
Well, that did come up last week. Congressman Don Young, who was Stevens' colleague, you know, from Alaska for many decades, said, you know, I want to see this guy keep doing something productive. Why doesn't he run for governor? Now Young's people were quick to say he's not trying to set up a Palin-Stevens duel, but that sort of was the implication. And would Ted Stevens do that? Would he run for governor at the age of 85? Hey, you know, it's anybody's guess. I think the idea, though, is that some Alaskans would like to see him back in public service. We did have a call-in program in Alaska, though, and a lot of folks called in and said they think he got off on a technicality. So the mood in Alaska is very split right now.
Huh, that's interesting. Well, I can't tell which aspect of the story I most love, the politics or the legal issues. I'll give you the final word, Stephen Gillers. You think Eric Holder is out of the woods on this one, and he's really had an opportunity to signal it's a new world at the Justice Department?
Well, he's half out of the woods. DOJ has taken a real hit, and it's going to take time to mend this wound. We're going to have to wait and see. But no one should fail to realize that Stevens was able to achieve this result because he was wealthy and because he had an excellent white-collar criminal defense firm. This is an endemic problem. There are lots of indigent or near-indigent defendants who are unable quickly to have their convictions overturned for prosecutorial misconduct. Sometimes never, and sometimes only after they've spent a decade or two in prison.
What a crucial point. Stephen Gillers is a professor of legal ethics at New York University. Thanks so much. And Libby Casey, a reporter for the Alaska Public Radio Network in Washington, D.C. As always, thanks to you, Libby.
So we want you to join the conversation that we're having on our website at the moment. If you're a parent, what in your life do you tell and not tell your kids? And what if your entire life happens to be on Facebook or the internet? Where do you draw the line?
It's Joe Asante again. I don't think parents tell their kids enough. And I think when kids find themselves in the same situations that their parents have been in, you know, many times before, they don't think their parents can relate. And the kids feel they're out of touch or they can't help them. And that's like the biggest crime in the world.
So tell us your take, 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, or send your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
The costs of a financial institution failing are just too great. If you're too big to fail, then you've got to be regulated so that you don't fail.
And that's John Coffey, director of the Columbia Law School's Center on Corporate Governance.
Which is available on our podcast, which is on our website. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Femi Okeh. You're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Upticking the shorts. It's not a laundry problem.
I hear from thousands of investors a week on this issue, but I hear from sophisticated investors, retail investors, institutions. There's some people who are strongly opposed as well, but there's clearly interest in our re-exploring this.
Securities and Exchange Commission Chief Mary Shapiro says betting that stocks go down may be a good bet these days, but it's not helping the market recover. Investors losing their shorts, now wanting them back. A new look at the uptick rule. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Yes, I'm still upticking away here. Good morning. It's Wednesday, April 8th. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Femi Okeh. Good morning. Adore Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. Coming up this hour, more news from the world of finance. 6 months after TARP's inception, we're here from one of the folks charged with making sure the Treasury is on track. We'll also talk about a new film that recounts a corrupt Texas drug raid that sent 27 people to jail for dealing crack cocaine, and almost all of them were African Americans. And what secrets are you keeping from your children, besides where you keep your candy stashed? These stories coming up, but first, headlines.
So Vermont is now the fourth state where same-sex marriage is legal. Beth Robinson is chairwoman of Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force.
We're thrilled. I mean, we've been this for 15 years, talking about our families, talking about our lives, to our legislators and to our neighbors and anybody who would listen. And we've been doing it because we knew that in the end it would pay off.
It took the state legislature in Vermont just one day to overturn Governor Jim Douglas's veto of a bill legalizing gay marriage. Vermont is the first state to legalize same-sex marriage by legislation instead of a court ruling. Illinois has a new congressman. Chicago Democrat Mike Quigley replaces President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. That was his district. Quigley won. He'll now represent most of the north side of Chicago. Femi?
Premier Silvio Berlusconi said that the death toll in Italy's earthquake has risen to 260 and 28,000 others were left homeless. Rescue workers will continue to search the rubble for survivors for another day. Their efforts have been hampered by hundreds of aftershocks since the initial 6.3 magnitude quake hit early on Monday. Somali pirates hijacked a cargo ship flying a U.S. flag off the coast of Somalia earlier this morning. 20 American crew members were on board. That's according to a statement from the Danish company that owns the ship. All of the crew members are believed to be safe, and the vessel is the sixth to be hijacked since Saturday.
The number six, count 'em. It's the University of Connecticut's sixth national title. The women won the NCAA championship last night.
A lot of people, I don't think, get to feel the feeling when you want something really bad and you work hard for it and then actually get it. I think that's one of the best feelings that it wasn't. You know, the scores might have showed that we won by a lot, but it wasn't easy.
That's Connecticut guard Renee Montgomery talking about the defeat of the Louisville Cardinals 76-54 last night. After the half, there was no turning back. UConn is possibly one of the most unstoppable teams in basketball history, 39 and zip this year. So the Dow and S&P look like they're going to maybe have a positive opening when the markets open in a few minutes. So the question for all of you is, what personal information do you want or can keep from your kids? 8778-MYTAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. You may have noticed, but when the financial emergency broke in the middle of the fall campaign last year, the Bush administration's strategy was to use money from the Federal Reserve to bail out the banks and help the economy get back in shape. Using that money from the Fed meant that Congress didn't have to get directly involved. But what congressional oversight there is of the so-called TARP showed up online last night.
The blanket subsidies provided to banks last fall under the Capital Infusion Plan failed to provide transparency, accountability, or clarity.
That's Elizabeth Warren, who chairs a panel charged with making sure the Treasury makes the right moves to stabilize the economy and manages the TARP fund effectively. Joining us to talk about what the panel said when it went online last night and issued a report, the first real congressional oversight report of the government's behavior with the TARP. Todd Zwillick is here, Takeaway's Capitol reporter down in Washington. First of all, what is important to note about what the report concluded? And does this really constitute accountability, Todd?
Well, what's important to note about it, and I know this isn't as clear as we'd like, the results are mixed. That's what they say, mixed. The history of this, you just described it very accurately, John. Up until now, especially last fall, when the TARP started, just like Elizabeth Warren said, it lacked transparency, lacked accountability, lacked a clear direction. That did not do anything to give the market certainty, and the markets function on certainty. And if you don't have that certainty, the report says it just makes the recovery time longer. I would, by the way, commend everyone to the video on cop.senate.gov. You played a cut from it. Elizabeth Warren explains things very clearly. It really helped me understand. It might help everyone understand where the panel's coming from. Going forward, their assessment is mixed. They say that the Treasury has made certain assumptions, and a lot of this is about those toxic assets. We've all heard about those bad mortgage-backed securities that are sitting on the balance sheets of all the financial institutions and all the banks. There's a big debate right now about the value of those assets. What are they really worth? So that when Treasury brings in all these private investors in this new plan to get them to invest in a subsidized way, there's a big debate about what the actual price is. And the reason that's important is if they don't find the real price and they value them too low or they value them too high, it just takes the market all the longer to find the real price, and that means a longer recovery time. Nobody really knows
The
value of those assets right now, and it's an issue.
Todd, have they established a set of standards that the Treasury is going to have to abide by going forward? And is that something we can actually monitor as U.S. citizens?
Well, there are standards, but the standards don't necessarily tell you the price. And the big takeaway from the report, from my reading of it, is that they've made certain assumptions and they're playing a game of dice here about whether, if the recovery is short, this PPIP, this public-private investor plan that Treasury is doing with investors, it could work. If it's a short recession, they could get us right through it, a nice bridge. If it's going to be a longer recession, they're playing a game of dice here,
right?
That nobody is sure how it will turn out, because nobody knows the exact value of those assets. If they don't get the asset valuation right of all these trillions of dollars of toxic assets, the recovery could be a lot longer in coming than it would have been if they hadn't done all this subsidization, these things Elizabeth Warren was talking about. That subsidized banks in a non-transparent way, all that does is add a gushiness to the market and uncertainty to the market, and all those things combined could make the problem even worse.
Todd Zwillick, the Takeaways Capital reporter. It's all about the economic assumptions in dealing with these various fiscal policies. Thanks, Todd.
Sure, my pleasure.
So here's Elizabeth Warren once again in that video described by Todd Zwillick.
In the report, we go over many technical ways to measure whether Treasury's efforts have helped the economy. At this point, we conclude that the evidence of success or failure is mixed.
The evidence of success or failure is mixed. Joining us now, Richard Nieman, as a member of the Congressional Oversight Panel, is on that same panel with Elizabeth Warren. He joins us here in the studio. Richard, would you agree with Elizabeth Warren that the record is mixed and that this constitutes accountability, what your panel has produced?
Well, I think Todd really pointed out to what the issue is, and this really that there is a debate on the assumptions underlying the Treasury's plan. And in fact, this report in its first paragraph highlights that there's disagreement among panel members about whether it is appropriate to assess alternatives at this stage. My view, as long as the assumptions are reasonable under the Treasury's plan and that the plan is viable, that is the approach that we should be pursuing.
Do you think the assumptions are correct?
I do.
So short recession?
No. The assumptions, really, the critical assumption underlying the plan is whether and it goes right to the price of those assets. Do the current prices reflect the fundamental values of those securities, or is there a liquidity discount built into that does not represent the fundamental value?
What strategy should the Treasury use in bailing out the banks? Should it be a direct subsidy? Should it be sort of market forces tweaking here and there like the Fed traditionally does, or something fundamentally different?
Well, I think the approach that you've seen they've taken is an extremely comprehensive approach along a number of factors, both private and public, including a great deals of focus on the foreclosure problem that gave rise to the crisis in the first place.
All right, let's say I'm an angry taxpayer. I watch Lou Dobbs every night, and I think that the government isn't watching the store, and my money is being given to a bunch of rich people. It's a war on the middle class. We got to shut this thing down. What's this panel doing to help me, the taxpayer, Richard?
Now, remember the panel. We have no direct authority over how that Treasury operates the program.
That's only making me madder.
Well, but what we can do, and we do understand the anger of the American public, is to provide ask the critical questions, and that's what this report does. Asks the question is, what is the strategy? Is it reasonable? Is it viable? And how can we measure its effectiveness?
Now, that sounds great, but you are at odds even with your chairman on the panel as to what to do. If you can't come to a consensus within the panel, how is that accountability?
Well, I think the importance of this panel is that it brings together a variety of individuals with different backgrounds, with different philosophical viewpoints and different political viewpoints. The power of the panel is in where we kind of reach a consensus. I think if you see my supplemental statement that I issued as part of that report, in fact, I was for the first time joined by former Senator Sununu, who also gave acknowledgement that the Treasury's plan is a viable plan, and that's where the focus of this panel should be.
Should they go back, the Treasury go back to Congress and ask for more money? Because right now the amount of obligations, $3 trillion, that they've signed the government up for, it may not be enough, according to some economists.
Well, I think that's premature. I think the focus, and we do have here where the funds have been outlaid, where they both had from the Fed, from the Treasury, and from the FDIC. But the focus should really be on the various elements of the plan. I think the American public, and we can play a part in this. This takes time to work. We won't see this in a month. We won't see this in 2 months. But a plan, we've already begin to see improvements in the commercial paper market, in bank borrowings. This has to be given a chance, but we have to keep the pressure on. Treasury has to do a better job in disclosing and clarifying and setting out the metrics as why and how we can demonstrate this is working.
All right, let's say I'm, again, a taxpayer, and I'm wandering around the lower Manhattan with a sandwich board on talking about my anger over AIG bonuses. Name three things that are on this website from your panel that are more important than the AIG bonuses for me to look at as a U.S. taxpayer.
Well, we should look at the total lending, the availability of these are complex issues. And the AIG bonuses and compensation are easy for people to understand. What is complex and takes more time to understand is the impact on the financial system. What we tried to address in October was we were at a precipice. We were at a risk of a financial collapse. We averted that through those actions. And now it's up to us to continue the focus on expanding the economy to get the banks lending. A large portion of credit availability in this country is a result of securitization market, lending by non-bank lenders. And that's where important part of the Treasury's program through the Federal Reserve is to restart that market.
And you think it is restarting?
The efforts now, parts of those programs are in the early stages, but that's what we're going to be focusing on.
All right. It is a mixed bag, according to the chairman. The TARP has failed, or the Treasury has failed, to provide transparency, accountability, or clarity. I'm wondering what you think the most important mission of your panel is, to provide an educational function for taxpayers or to sting the Treasury when it does wrong?
We have to play a critical role. There are some real questions out there that have to be asked, such as what's the impact of banks who want to redeem those securities? What's the impact of mark-to-market accounting? Do we have the right number of managers in the PPIP program?
Well, those are the questions, and the American taxpayers will need the answers. Richard Nieman is a member of the Congressional Oversight Panel looking at the TARP's administration. COP.gov is where you can get more information. He's also the New York State Superintendent of Banks. Thanks, Richard.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So, come on over here. Let me just talk to you. Just you and me. No one else is listening. So, were you a real hard partier in college? Do your kids know about it? Huh? That's the question. That's what we're doing here on the show today. In the age of the internet, how do you keep personal details from getting found out by your kids? And what has a parent told you as a child that you wish they hadn't? What's too much information? We'll be talking more about this later in the show, but we want to know what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. How much should parents tell their children about their lives? Femi?
So I'm just going to rewind you back to November 2000, when there was no bigger news than the battle for the presidency between George Bush and Al Gore. But in the tiny central Texas town of Hearn, there was one story even bigger than the election. A military-style drug raid by the authorities sent 27 people to jail on felony charges of distributing crack cocaine. Nearly all of them were African-American. The film American Violet is a dramatization of the events in Hearn. It opens in some theaters this month, and that's next Friday, April the 17th. And we're really lucky to have in the studio with us this morning Bill Haney. He's a producer and writer of the film, and Nicole Beharie, who plays Dee Roberts, a character that's based on a real character that was involved in that drug raid. So, Bill, let me start with you. The raid happens almost right at the beginning of the movie. So what is the movie actually about? What's the concept of the film?
Well, you know, the story is about the behavior of an extraordinary young woman caught up in this raid. A woman, an innocent woman, dragged into prison as part of the war on drugs as played out in Hearn, Texas in November 2000. And she's given Sophie's choice. She has an opportunity. She's got four young children at home, all under the age of eight. She's given an opportunity to either plead guilty to a crime she hasn't done, and for which there's been no hard evidence found, and go home that night to her children, but as a convicted felon, losing a series of her federal rights and benefits, including, importantly, her right to vote. Or she can stay in prison, supported only by a, ill-trained, underpaid public defender who himself feels complicit in this system, and fight the charges, risking 16 to 25 years in prison, and 6 months in jail while she stays. And it's a lot about what she decides to do, how the system reacts, and what the consequences for her family, her community, and the rest of us are.
Well, Dee in the movie gets the help of an ACLU lawyer who comes down to Texas to help her out. And there's a conversation between that lawyer and the pastor about the problems with the drug laws and the laws in Texas. Have a listen to a little clip from American Violet.
Texas law says a grand jury can indict them on the word of a single informant.
So all I have to do is accuse you?
And then I can be indicted and arrested, and I'm told to take the plea or else.
And this system is an abomination. Poor black folks are easy pickings.
But we can change the system. We're going to hit this DA really hard.
Up in the city, a DA may not be a big deal, but down here, he rules like a king.
Let me just bring in Nicole. Nicole, you play the key character, one of the key characters of Dee Roberts. What do you love about her? She's very lovable, but she's not perfect.
I think that's probably what I love about her. She's three-dimensional in that, she has made choices in her life that keep her from being sort of the perfect heroine, and we've all sort of been there, and that she's a person that people can ignore, or people would at first glance toss to the side and say she probably did do this, but when you take a closer look, you realize how much courage she has.
And it's about grabbing credibility. I mean, it reminds me of Aaron Brockovich in a sense, but it's a very, very different take.
And I was thinking that just last night as I was watching it, because Dee gets herself into trouble even as she's trying to fight the DA. And you're watching going, Dee, what are you doing that for?
Well, the actual, woman that it's based on, she has a real sense of right and wrong. And it's tremendously clear to her. And I think, after she sort of fights for her children and faces hardship, all she thinks of is, I have to do this, I have to do this. And really, some of the repercussions seem not to be as important, or as she doesn't consider them quite as much as I think you and I would think.
Now, the woman it's based on is a real person called Regina Kelly.
Correct.
And she's actually on YouTube. I had a look at her today. How is it playing somebody who's really out there and has got her own personality?
You have a tremendous sense of responsibility when you do that. We met each other on set, and she was actually here yesterday. So I watched a lot of footage of her and kind of studied her and saw her YouTube information. And, you know, it's kind of scary because the first time I saw the film was at the Telluride Film Festival, and I had never seen myself in, like, you know, a feature-length movie, and she grabbed me and told me to sit beside her. So it was one of those very interesting, like, this is my first time seeing this, seeing this film, and she was there. But, you know, it's also a huge gift, and I'm just glad that we got to share the story.
Let me just wrap up, Bill. I have seen the entire movie, so I know the little comment that happens at the end. But the movie is about really plea bargaining and how suspect it happens to be. That was back in 2000. Bring us up to date now. Does this film have relevance for us right now today?
Well, you know, I would say, first, from my point of view, I hope people find, and I hope you found, the film to be entertaining and engaging and dramatically compelling. And, you know, last night we did a screening, and it is a story that where people laugh and they cry and they feel moved to action. And it's a story that shows some extraordinary performances, Alfre Woodard and Charles Dutton in Exhibit and Tim Blake Nelson and Will Patton. But most importantly, Nicole's, you know, really breathtaking performance. And it is an important American story.
Great cast.
Thank you. And they were really at the top of their game. But it's an important American story, and it's a story about the war on drugs, the consequences of the $100 billion a year war on drugs, and how an inspiring woman could take a step that may help us all.
Thanks, Bill Haney. He's the writer and producer of the film American Violet, also starring Nicole Beharie. You can see the film out in selected theaters on April the 17th. Mark Garrison now has your latest news headlines.
Thank you, Femi. 29 minutes after the hour, a suspected U.S. missile strike in Pakistan hit in the northwest today, killing two militants. Intelligence officials say it targeted the stronghold of Pakistan's top Taliban chief. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke got another earful of complaints from Pakistan's government about these missile strikes on Pakistani territory when he visited the country earlier this week. An American journalist detained in Iran is now accused of spying. Iranian-American Roxana Saberi was first jailed months ago on charges she didn't have a proper press ID. And 20 American crew members are aboard a Danish cargo ship seized by Somali pirates off the African coast. That's the sixth ship seized in a week. John and Femi.
Don't know what to make of that pirate story. I'll have to watch that. Thank you, Mark.
We'll see.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So if you've disclosed all of your personal life in a memoir or on Facebook and the Internet, what can you do when it's time for your kids to learn about your life? That conversation coming up. But as a parent, where do you draw the line? And kids, has a parent told you something you wish they hadn't?
Hi, my name is Kwame. I'm from Brooklyn. And something my parent told me that I regret that they did was, my mother once told me that she had an abortion when she was younger, and I'm an only child, and I always wish for a brother or sister. And although I didn't bother my mother with it, it bothered me for a long time, and I still quite often think about it.
Wow. Sarah emails us, I'm the oldest of five in a patchworked family, and my stepmother told me when I was 13 that if she had to do it all over again, she wouldn't have had children. Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Keep the stories coming.
Wow, some of them are really painful.
Yeah.
Let me take you to Cuba, because on Tuesday, Cuba granted three of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus the first meeting with Fidel Castro by American officials since he fell ill in 2006. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Democrat from California and chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus, was among those who traveled to Havana and met with Fidel. She's just back from Cuba and joins us.
It was a very good meeting. We were very pleased to see that he's doing well. He is very energetic and enthusiastic, clear thinking, knew what the delegation's purpose was in Havana. And, in fact, we talked a lot about many different subjects, but bottom line, he also believes that it's time to normalize relations between the United States and Cuba.
Were there any specific things he said to you that really stay in your mind from that experience of meeting him?
He asked a lot of questions about Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., for example. He is a student of Dr. King, but wanted to know more books and more information about Dr. King and his life. But the conversation was general, and we talked about issues of foreign policy and basically the new world in which we live and why the Cuban people believe that normalization of relations is in the best interest of the American people and of the Cuban people.
Now, probably your most important meeting must have been with the current president, Raul Castro. What did you get out of that meeting?
Well, we met with President Raul Castro for about 4 hours the night before. And again, we wanted to get a sense of what was required from their point of view to move forward in dialogue with the United States. We learned from President Raul Castro that they do want dialogue and discussions based on mutual respect and sovereignty, and that all issues that the United States and Cuba is concerned with would be on the table for discussion. And I think that's an important message that we are communicating back to our president, because our president is certainly doing a wonderful job in reshaping America's role and image in the world. And we believe that he needs to look at our recommendations prior to the Summit of the Americas, April 17th, so that he will get a sense of what our views are on this as he meets with Latin American countries. All 15 Latin American countries have diplomatic relations with Cuba. It's unfortunate that the United States is isolated in our policies, and 68% of the American people want normal relations with Cuba, the right to travel to Cuba. Furthermore, the economic interests of our own business community are at stake. When you look at the new markets that are provided to American businesses, if we allow trade with Cuba, when you look at the fact that we're in an economic downturn and there are many, many opportunities for our farmers, for our workers here to work on projects in Cuba. They had a devastating hurricane. So it's in our national interest to normalize relations.
Did you feel that Cuba was ready to have that conversation and they've been ready for some time? Or do you think it's the way that President Obama is actually talking to the rest of the world, including Cuba, that's you seem to have made some kind of breakthrough with the delegation?
I have visited Cuba since the mid-70s, and my sense always after conversations and traveling there many times was that the Cuban people, the Cuban government, wanted normal relations with Cuba. Now I believe the world, including Cuba, are very optimistic about this new direction in our foreign policy. President Obama has said he wants to turn the page. He said that on his recent very successful visit abroad. And so quite naturally, a country 90 miles away is very enthusiastic about the possibilities. It's not going to be easy, though, and they understand the political dynamics that are operating, and they understand, though, that there could be executive orders issued by the president that could begin to unravel.
But Congresswoman, I mean, I understand the incentives from Cuba's perspective, but how do you answer the charge? You're just making Raul Castro look good by going down there and talking with him and having a folksy meeting with Fidel.
It's not a matter of making anyone look good. This is a matter of representing the viewpoints of 68% of the American people and having discussions with regard to how Americans or what conditions would be required to allow for the travel of American citizens to Cuba and to allow our businesses to engage in business activities. We care about our own country's role in the world, and when you look at the fact that we are very isolated, then I say, and members of our delegation say, it's time to talk to Cuba.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Congresswoman Barbara Lee is a Democrat from California and the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus. Time to catch up with your news headlines. Mark Garrison.
Thanks, Femi. 21 minutes before the hour, Vermont lawmakers narrowly overrode the governor's veto to legalize gay marriage yesterday. It's now the fourth state to make it legal and the first to do so by legislation as opposed to a court ruling. Same-sex couples can marry starting September 1st. Several other states have similar bills in the works. The death toll in Italy's earthquake is now at 260. Rescue workers will continue to search the rubble for survivors. They've been hampered, though, by hundreds of aftershocks, some very strong, since the 6.3 magnitude quake hit central Italy on Monday. An American space tourist is now back on Earth. The Russian Soyuz capsule touched down in Kazakhstan a few hours ago, carrying the tourist and two crew members. It's fresh off a trip to the International Space Station. Software billionaire Charles Simonyi paid $35 million for the trip. It's its second time in space, but it may be the last tourist trip to the space station for a while. The permanent crew up there will soon double to six, so there won't be room for high-rolling vacationers. A big day in history, 35 years ago today. This is the anniversary of Hank Aaron breaking Babe Ruth's home run record.
Pitch by Downing. Swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is going to be out of here. It's gone. It's 7-15. There's a new home run champion of all time, and it's Henry Aaron.
Aaron broke the record when he hit his 715th home run. He kept going, getting all the way to 755. That record, of course, stood until 2007 when controversial slugger Barry Bonds broke the record. John Fenner.
Yeah, Aaron Bonds doesn't count. Henry Aaron, ladies and gentlemen, the man. Thank you, Mark Garrison.
You got it.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Femi Okay.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And you know what the electrical grid is. If you're listening to this program and your radio is plugged into the wall, you're on the grid. Some people love to be off the grid. And think of the grid as some kind of like electronic Borg mentality that controls all of our lives. Well, spies perhaps have taken control of the electrical grid in the United States. It's part of an exclusive story from the Wall Street Journal. And the reporter on that story, Siobhan Gorman, joins us now. She's the intelligence correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. She joins us from Washington. Siobhan, this is an incredibly significant story. We've all heard about frailties on the electric power grid, but you're describing intelligence vulnerabilities. How have authorities discovered this?
Well, they've basically found, you know, electronic signatures that allow them then to track back to where data basically has been stolen from the computer networks that control the various components of the electrical grid. And it looks like that data has been, what they say, exfiltrated back to countries like China and Russia. One quick thing, it's not necessarily that spies have taken control of the electric grid, but more that they've been on a surveillance mission to go through various components of the grid and try to understand what controls turn important components on and off, or how it is that various things work. In addition, they have left behind, on some occasions, software tools that would then allow them later on to remotely activate them and perhaps destroy portions of the electric network.
All right, now this is how, you know, the internet works. If you log on to a website, sometimes you get cookies uploaded to your site, and those things can operate inside your computer. Is there any sense that an infrastructure is slowly being put in place that would address the questions of control as opposed to simply knowing what the grid is and having that information as an intelligence matter?
You mean any evidence that the cyber spies have put in things that would allow them to control the grid?
Control or disrupt or anything
like
that?
That's what I meant when I said that they've left behind these software tools that would then allow them later at some point when there was a crisis where they felt that it was to their strategic advantage to come back and destroy or disrupt the electric grid and also other infrastructure. The story focuses on the electric grid, but this is true for other key elements of the U.S. infrastructure as well.
The Department of Homeland Security has already suggested that cyber, you know, espionage and cyber terrorism are significant vulnerabilities that the United States has to deal with. Does this up the ante on that declaration from Homeland Security?
It does, and in fairness to the government, this is in part why they're so concerned. I mean, this is something that intelligence officials have been following for a while, and they've been increasingly concerned. My understanding is that there's been sort of an uptick, that it increased significantly last year in particular. Now, that may just be that we're more aware of it now, but I know that there are lots of people within the U.S. government who are mobilizing to try to manage this, but the challenge is that when you're talking about a whole host of computer networks that are all serving private companies, it's much harder for the government to take action that's really going to affect things quickly because you're talking about the private sector.
And you're also talking about a complicated computer system that, I mean,
yes,
the government could conceivably do harm here trying to install all kinds of countermeasures, right?
You would certainly want to be careful about how you did it, yes. You wouldn't want to disrupt the system while you're trying to save it.
Well, everybody's watching everybody else. We would presume that the U.S. is probably looking at grids around the world as a result of all of the changes in electronic surveillance. Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent at The Wall Street Journal, an exclusive story from The Wall Street Journal on electronic surveillance of the U.S. power grid. Thank you, Siobhan.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Femi O'Kay, and Mark Garrison is here with the news of one of my favorite ongoing stories, piracy off the east coast of Africa. Mark.
Thank you, Femi. It's 12 minutes before the hour, and in this case it involves American crew members, 20 of them, the company says. They're aboard a Danish cargo ship seized by Somali pirates off the African coast. This is the sixth ship seized in a week, despite increased international patrols there. Typically, ships and crews are released once pirates collect a hefty ransom. Analysts say recent good weather is part of why attacks have spiked recently. Maritime authorities say the American crew members are believed to be unhurt.
We don't think Femi's happy about that, do we?
No.
Oh, okay, good.
General enthusiasm for an unusual story.
If we go a few weeks and I don't hear about pirates in Somalia, I think something has gone wrong with the world.
Well, the waters are pretty active over there. They had a little bit of a lull recently, but that was part of the because of weather and not necessarily because of the patrols there. But it's a story that we're following, so we'll watch that. This is what it sounds like on the streets of Thailand today. Tens of thousands of people are demonstrating there. Riot police say they've arrested more than 200 people after protests turned violent in some areas. That crowd gathered outside the home of the king's top advisor calling for his resignation. Protesters say he orchestrated the 2006 coup rather, that ousted the former prime minister. They want the current office holder out and new elections held. John and Femi.
Thank you, Mark. So all morning we've been asking all of you, where do you draw the line on what to tell your kids about your personal life?
I'm Randy Cohen. I'm calling from New York, where I write the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine. For me, the older the child, the more you may choose to confide. When my daughter was around 12, she asked if I'd ever smoked pot, and I told her the truth, that I and every productive, healthy, happy adult she knew had smoked pot at some time when they were younger. Some do today, but not when we were 12. I tried to provide some context, some understanding of what we were talking about, and of course to remind her that I've lived drug-free for 30 years and that she still has to clean up her room.
Some issues for parents there. Parent Heather Armstrong, I've got a question for you. You've made a career disclosing personal information about yourself. When do I tell my children that I'm actually a space alien? When?
I think the answer to that is never.
Never. Ever, thank ever. You. Heather Armstrong writes the blog deuce.com. She's the author of the book It Sucked and Then I Cried, How I Had a Baby, a Breakdown, and a Much-Needed Margarita. She joins us from Austin, Texas. Heather, you know, you've put a lot of your life online and in your book. I've also written a memoir. I have 2 10-year-olds and 2 7-year-olds. You have a 5-year-old. You have to have a strategy for how they're going to learn about what mommy and daddy did before they were born, right?
Right.
And
well,
what's yours?
I think, I mean, it's much like what I'm willing to write about her on my website publicly for millions of people to read, in that the boundaries sort of shift and change as she becomes more aware and can handle more information. When I started my website back in 2001, I was single, and I like to call myself a recovering Mormon, and living in Los Angeles and exploring, you know, the recreational side of drug use and other, and, you know, things that she will eventually find out about me, because it's very public and millions of people know this about me. And much like the guy who said previously, it's something that when she comes to an age where she can handle it, I absolutely plan to talk to her about it.
But how much control can you have when it's possible for, you know, a 7-year-old? My 7-year-olds know how to Google me. They haven't done it yet, I don't think. But, you know, that's going to be a scary moment.
Yeah, and there already have been some scary moments. My book that was recently published, I got a hard copy of it in the mail, and she sort of grabbed it out of my hands and turned to the 16-page photographic insert, and there were all these pictures of her. And at 5 years old, she's actually reading on a third-grade level, and she started to read the captions underneath of the photos and would look at me like, what? You said this about me?
So what do you do? You go, nice reading, sweetheart. Hand mommy the book now. Is that,
I mean, it's a book I wrote about you, sweetie. It's called It Sucked and Then I Cried.
Yeah, great work. Well, you know, have you talked to parents and have people contacted you on your blog, you know, who have actually crossed this bridge maybe with older kids? You know, Randy Cohen is talking about his daughter who's a teenager now. You know, for us, it's a little premature, but how have people handled this?
I actually have several friends who have teenage children, and invariably, it hasn't been that big of a deal because their kids are now so immersed in social networks that it's like, my mom smoked pot, and my mom used to do this and whatnot. It's just not a big deal. And I think it's going to become increasingly more that way because kids, for them, this public knowledge, it's how they're growing up, and it doesn't seem strange to them that there is sort of that privacy is sort of being peeled away.
Is it also true that what you think your kids would have trouble knowing about you is actually not what they will have trouble knowing about you? That what you choose to keep secret maybe is the most boring information about you from a kid's perspective?
Right. I think my daughter is going to be much more horrified when she's pictures of my hair at age 13 than she will be that I ever, you know, smoked pot once.
What about some of the really tough issues, you know, previous marriages, the fact that, I mean, obviously the huge one is, you know, he's not my daddy or something like that. How do you handle that sort of stuff?
You know, you have to open lines of communication with your child, and you know, for instance, like I'm pregnant with my second child, and everybody's like, well, have you had the sex talk with her yet? I'm like, she's 5 years old. I'm not going to have this talk with her. And then all of a sudden she actually found a book in our collection that talks explicitly about sex, and she started reading it and comes up to me and she says, what is this picture of, Mom? And it's like, oh dear. Let's go talk to your father about that. And it's all a matter of just opening the lines of communication and saying and speaking in words that correspond to the age that they're at. I mean, my husband has an ex-wife, and I'm sure she's going to approach us one day. And I really don't see us encountering any problems talking to her about that subject at all.
But your anxiety actually maybe doesn't mirror her anxiety about knowing it. And you know, you can't just do these things casually. Yet in this internet age, information is out there whether you know it or not, right?
That's why you set up a fund for therapy.
Is there anything you would never tell your daughter?
There's nothing I would never tell the internet. I mean, I'm a totally open book, and anything that she wanted to know, I would absolutely tell her. I mean, I have no problem talking to anybody about anything.
Yeah, we've kind of noticed that. But you know, what do you say to parents who actually want to retain control, who actually do have difficulty with some of this personal information and don't particularly relish the thought of doing their own deuce.com blog disclosing a lot of information about their lives?
Stay very, very, very far away from the internet. And I probably, you know, monitor their children's use of the internet as much as they possibly can if they're that worried. Although, I mean, children are creative people and can find ways around those, you know, those instruments. But, you know, I think children are becoming so much more savvy that this is a problem that we're all going to have to deal with.
And finally, you write about postpartum depression in your book, It Sucked and Then I Cried, How I Had a Baby, a Breakdown, and a Much-Needed Margarita. Have you phrased the answer to the question that your daughter may ask someday, Mom, why did having me make you so depressed?
Why did having me make me so depressed, Mom? And my answer to that is there's something wrong with my brain. It has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with the genes that I inherited from your very crazy aunts and uncles. That's where we'll go with that.
It works for me. Good answer. You got a chance to edit it over the next couple of decades anyway. Heather Armstrong, thanks so much for being with us. She's the writer of the hugely popular blog Deuce.com. That's D-O-O-C-E.com. And the author of It Sucked and Then I Cried, How I Had a Baby, a Breakdown, and a Much-Needed Margarita. Thank you, Heather.
So Heather talked about her sticky issues with her children, but how much would you tell your kids about your life? And kids, what has a parent told you that you wish you didn't know?
So, TMI from parents. When I was younger, maybe about 18, 19, and my parents had recently divorced, and my mother was figuring out that I was old enough to handle the news, so she mentioned to me that she had an abortion back in her home country in the Caribbean before she had me, and it kind of just rocked my world because I had been so used to being the oldest child, and now to find out that I was technically the oldest child had not someone else been born. So it was a little bit upsetting, but you know, now that it's 10 years, the news has come and it's sobering news, but I'm actually glad that she told me, even though it was definitely TMI when I was an older teen.
So wow. Almost, yeah, that is definitely
that's
TMI.
That's the second one of those kind of stories.
Yeah, so we're almost done with our conversation on the air, but the conversation continues on the website, thetakeaway.org, and here is your takeaway.
These are complex issues. The AIG bonuses and compensation are easy for people to understand. What is complex and takes more time to understand is the impact on the financial system.
That's Richard Nieman, member of the Congressional Oversight Panel and the New York State Superintendent of Banks.
I'm John Hockenberry.
You're sounding better, John.
Thank you.
I'm your tonic. I'm Femi OK. And this is The Takeaway.
You can't handle the truth.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,